Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hila Fala, professor of philosophy at East Tennessee State University. My guest this morning is Cecil Abbott, distinguished fellow in the Harvard Center of Population and Development Studies, and our topic today is honesty in public life. Professor Abbott, glad to have you with us.
Thanks very much. I'm delighted to be here.
I think it'd be helpful if perhaps you would give the listener a little bit of background about yourself, what your academic interests are, and then talk a little bit about what prompted you to write the book called Lying.
Well, my main field is and always has been really ethics, and in particular practical ethics. I'm very interested in the ways in which we reflect on ethics and try to incorporate ethics into our lives, sometimes try to avoid doing so, in all kinds of different circumstances, in family life, in individual life, in government, in journalism. I've been fortunate in having had the chance to work with people in many different professions and sometimes to teach, for instance, medical ethics and government ethics and, you know, a number of other courses of that kind. The reason I got into writing the book Lying, and that, by the way, came out 1978, so I was writing it in the late 70s, middle 70s, the reason was that I was teaching medical ethics at the time, and I could not understand why there was so little discussion of what seemed to me to be an absolutely crucial question, namely how health professionals and patients communicate and how sometimes they might lie, sometimes they might indeed be honest. There are patients who lie to physicians as well, and then of course the large question at the time was the much more commonplace practice of lying to people who are seriously ill or dying on the part of health professionals. That's changed to some extent now, but at the time it was very common. So that began my thinking about writing a book. Then I looked around and I saw that in other professions the same thing was happening. There was very little discussion about lawyers lying in court or people in government lying to citizens or to other governments, and yet everybody knew that the problems were there and were very important. So then I looked back and I noticed that in antiquity and indeed in the Middle Ages and in many religious traditions, these questions had been discussed, and I proposed to a publisher that I would do an anthology on this subject. And this was André Schifrin, at the time director of Pantheon Books, now director of something called the New Press. And André said, well, Cicela, why don't you write your own book and you can have some of what you wanted to have in the anthology in an appendix instead. But really, there are enough problems right now so that we shouldn't rely only on classical texts. And he talked me into that, in fact, and so I did write the book.
All right. In that book, some of the things you talk about, you make the claim that people in public life often talk about lying in a rather cavalier way. And later on, you talk about existing deceptive practices. I'm curious whether you think things have changed in the 20 years since you've written the book, or whether you think there still is this tendency for people in the public life to talk about lying in a rather cavalier way, whether there are still substantial existing deceptive practices.
I do think that there are still certainly existing deceptive practices. There are a number of circumstances that have changed. When I wrote the book, we were still living with the extraordinary amount of deception that had gone on in the war in Vietnam, and also with the aftermath of Watergate. So for myself and for many people in America at the time, in the 70s, the question of whether you could trust government was a very, very important one. People in public life actually didn't talk that much about it then. I found very few scholarly articles. I think I managed to dig up one which said that public officials have the right to lie when they think it's a good idea. But at the same time, I'm sure that they talked perhaps among themselves and sometimes on tapes such as President Nixon's tapes. We only found out about those later, of course. what was on them. So the practices were powerfully noticeable at the time, and I think at the time that they had led to a great lowering of trust. There were many statistics showing that from President Eisenhower's presidency onward, there had been a tremendous loss in trust in public servants. I think now the trust is unfortunately still very low, and there have been many other examples, many other practices. We found out about such things as Iran Gate, for instance, with the most amazing kinds of lying and opportunities for lying that probably earlier presidents hadn't even thought of. Personnel such as Colonel Oliver North, who indeed was very open about why he thought it had been a good idea to lie. That simply hadn't happened at all in the past. So now we have a lot more writing on the subject of lying, a lot more analysis. Philosophers have gotten into it in a very interesting way, and often, you know, a thoughtful way. Social scientists have gotten into it, I think often less thoughtfully, in fact. But there's a lot more talk about lying. As for whether there's actually more lying going on by public officials, I'm always hesitant to try to estimate, because the what you might call the successful lie, namely the lie that isn't uncovered, is by definition a lie we don't know anything about. So that makes it very, very hard to compare what's happening now, what was happening in the 70s, or for that matter, 100 years ago.
All right, what I'd like to do is maybe approach this in two steps. One would be to talk about what do people use as a justification for lying? And then we'll go back and look at those arguments and see what your response is. So let's begin with the first step. People, government officials, elected officials, bureaucrats, do appear to lie to the public, perhaps without much thought. How do they try to justify that practice?
I think that they use a number of justifications. Some of them are what I call, you know, rationalizations. For instance, there is a huge umbrella excuse called national security, and that was what was going on in Vietnam, and that was what was going on in Watergate to some extent also, namely the idea that in order to protect the presidency or whatever other agency was involved, it is unfortunately necessary to lie, and that this helps protect national security. So that is one vast umbrella. My view always is that one should pare away and pare away and pare away, and to see when is national security indeed at stake, and when does it require lying. A sub-part of that, I think, is indeed lying to enemies. I have a chapter in the book called Lying to Enemies, and I show there that, yes, in times of war, indeed, there are times when it is necessary for survival to tell lies, but that does not mean that it is at all necessary always to lie to adversaries, and also very much not necessary always to lie to citizens, and yet those two things are often connected. Another important justification that some people would bring out had to do with winning an election. The idea is that if this particular person can win an election, say to be senator or member of Congress or president, then that person will do so much good that it is worth telling some lies in order to get elected, and that the end will justify the means under those circumstances. Then there are some people who would argue that the public is simply so ignorant, it knows so little, you can't trust people to make the right decisions, so unfortunately, since you know so much more and you are an expert, that's a reason to lie. I tried to distinguish in my book between justifications and excuses, and there are a lot of excuses operating in there, and not many good justifications. There is a whole other category also, and that's the so-called white lie, namely a lie that the person who tells the lie doesn't think has, that person does not think that that particular lie has any effect at all. Possibly helps people somewhat, but certainly doesn't have any harmful effect. And, you know, that's another huge category that doesn't only at all have to do with people in public service, but in life in general. Well, there are quite a few others, but you may want to mention some also.
Well, actually, what I'd like to do, taking the answer that you've just provided, would this be fair to say that you are not an absolutist? That is, you do not believe that lying is always wrong. On the other hand, what you do believe is that we lie far more often than is justified. Is that a fair assumption?
Yes, I think that that is a fair assumption. I would argue that there are some exceptional categories when saying what you don't mean in order to mislead other people may be justified, but that they're very narrow categories, and the whole impulse when we are in the perspective of the person thinking about telling a lie, the whole impulse is to expand those categories and to think up new excuses for ourselves and to imagine that we're not doing very much harm. One kind of case that I took up is the famous case that the many philosophers, and perhaps most famously Immanuel Kant, discussed, namely, what do you say to someone who is coming to intending to kill your friend? Your friend is hiding in your house, or you know where your friend is, and here comes the person who is going to try to kill him, and it's an innocent person, your friend also. In our days, it might be a Nazi. People often have used that example, hunting down Jewish families, and you are having them in your house. So should you lie then? Kant said, even then, you must not do it. And my argument, and probably most people's argument, is yes, you can under those circumstances. It is too important to protect the person, to protect the innocent human life, and therefore a lie would be all right. However, I would say also that if you could do something else, if you could bore the person to tears, for instance, so that he forgot altogether that he was hunting his victim, that would obviously be better. I believe also, actually, that Kant, being so brilliant and so articulate, would probably have detained this supposed murderer for so long that the friend would have managed to escape and hide. Kant wouldn't have had to lie, but I do feel that most of us are not up to that kind of delay tactic. So that is one exception. Another exception that isn't really an exception is when you're involved in circumstances where everybody indeed is saying what is not true. Let's say some kind of card game like bluff. Well, of course it's all right to lie in that kind of game, or poker or something like that, because that's what's expected. Those are the rules. And I see no problem about that. However, I don't really think what's going on there is deceptive in the same way. A third category might be when there is literally nothing at stake at all, a truly white lie, so-called. But that, I think, is actually rather hard to find. And there I feel very strongly that we have to try to use our imagination to think of things to say that are not deceptive. People often say, well, what are you supposed to say when your spouse comes and asks, you know, how do you like my necktie or my hat? And there I think there are all kinds of humorous things you can say, or imaginative things. You don't have to lie at all. That example is often brought up. So there are those three then, the first being some extreme crisis, the second being some practice or game in which it is accepted that you lie or tell or try to mislead the other people, and the third, a totally innocent, innocuous white lie. All of them, however, I think, are such that all those three categories are such that it's very important to lean over backwards, not to believe that you're in one of them.
Okay, before we proceed to discuss each of those in a little more detail, I'd like to pause briefly for the benefit of anyone who may be tuning in late. My guest today on Ideas and Issues is Cecila Bach. distinguished fellow in the Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies, and we are discussing honesty in the public life. Just before the break, you summarized three types of cases where lying might be justified. And by your own account, the second one arguably isn't a lie at all. And the third is going to be extremely rare. So let's focus in the first category, because that may be the category that people would use in trying to justify, public officials might use to try to justify lying to citizens or to Congress or to the administration. And the case you gave is one in which the stakes are extremely high, and secondly, in which it appears there is no alternative. And in your account, both of those things are true. It's, you can't lie simply because the stakes are high. It also has to be the case that there is no alternative to lying.
Yeah, right. I think both of those are important considerations. And I would say a third one often is that this would fall under the idea that there are no alternatives. You are surprised. Something has to happen quickly. You don't have time to think up alternatives. Now, that isn't always true, but that makes it all the more likely that you're not going to be able to think of the right thing to do. I think all of us, in fact, can imagine easily being in situations, perhaps also when the stakes are not so high. We're confronted with a situation, we don't know what to do, and we slip into or reach out for some kind of lie. I think that that's a problem. We have to try to think ahead so that we can deal better with such circumstances. But I do think that that's very, very different from something that I regard as much worse, really, and that is to engage in a practice of lying, to say that I am going to do this. It's not that I'm surprised right now or anything. It's not that I have no chance to think of alternatives. It is that I'm deciding to do this. For instance, if you are going to falsify documents, if you are going to appear in court and lie, if you have a practice of, as a physician, to lie to patients, perhaps with cancer, all of those practices are really quite different from the kind of being taken by surprise that all of us can imagine, and indeed all of us have slipped into.
I wonder, though, if those two aren't related, at least in the following sense, that we're much more inclined to slip into the lie, as you described it, if we don't take the time to think about the practice of lying and how important it is to tell the truth. And by the same token, the public official who systematically lies to the public is just someone who's never taken the time to think about what it means to deceive the public. They just do it, and they think it's okay. Partly, I suppose, because they may be part of an institution which says it's okay.
I think that's a very good point you're making there. And this is why I also think, actually, that teaching practical ethics has a role in allowing students and others to think ahead, to imagine how it would be if they were a physician, a lawyer, a public official, and to come to some kind of conclusion about how they want to lead their lives. Because I think you're right, you can slip into something because you're not thinking ahead, and all of a sudden you can also then be indeed in the practice without having planned it at all. However, when somebody, let's say somebody is asked to falsify a document, to me that isn't something you just slip into. There I do think, you know, most people will have made a choice of some kind. But again, to come back to what you were saying, if they haven't thought more broadly about what is involved in making that choice, they may be more likely to make the wrong one.
Let's slightly shift gears here a moment. What's wrong with lying? I mean, you know, we've been talking so far as if lying to the public is bad, that we lie more often than we should, that we slip into lies, that we adopt practices of lying. Suppose someone says, what's wrong with lying?
Yeah, that it's good that you ask that, because there are a certain number of people who do ask just that, and some of them defend a number of lies in public life. There are books written on that subject. I would say that there are three kinds of things that are wrong. First of all, and perhaps most clearly, you do wrong the person that you tell the lie to. In a way, you assume a kind of power over that person by shifting the information that that person would otherwise have, say, about how to vote, about their own health or illness, about perhaps the fidelity of their spouse, or many, many other things. So you wrong the person you're speaking to, and if you ask people who've been lied to, indeed, they are not at all so cheery about the question, what's wrong about lying. They definitely think that there's something wrong, and I think we always have to learn to shift perspective. Just as you were saying, we have to learn to think about the difference between just one case and the whole practice. So we also have to learn to shift perspective between the person who's thinking about the lie, weighing whether it's a good or bad thing, and the person who is at the receiving end. Another person who is being harmed, I do think myself, is the liar or the person telling the lie. Now, what happens, I think, when we engage in lies is that we know something that others may not know, but we know that we are not to be trusted. Interestingly to me, Kant, Immanuel Kant, in his last book, The Anthropology, that I think is very impressive, when he was talking about character, said that the only way we can know whether or not we have character is if we can know that we are trying as hard as we can to be honest with other people and with ourselves. I wish I'd known that quote when I wrote the book Lying. It's going to come into my next edition. So it's the liar is being injured and definitely the person lied to. But I then also think that there are larger considerations, and this has to do with trust more generally. For instance, after Watergate and all the lying in the war in Vietnam, trust in government went down, trust in many other professions. And what this did was to make it harder for people to work with one another. How easy is it to work with people or vote for people that you don't trust? And that may be the largest danger of them all. Now that we have, you know, we've seen so much in the way of scandals on Wall Street, scandals in banks, scandals in government, trust is much lower, and I think this really does interfere a lot with the possibility for working together for common goals. So that is the third kind of harm.
Okay. I'm curious about a connection, too, that we might make. I mean, we've been talking today primarily about honesty in the public life. It's strikes me there's also a very close connection between honesty in the public life and honesty in the private life, and the two sorts of connections. One is that if we as individual citizens tend to lie very cavalierly to others, it seems to me we create an environment where it's easier for public officials to lie to us. And secondly, the very three sorts of reasons you just gave about why it's wrong to lie, it's especially clear why it's wrong for public officials to lie to citizens for each of those three reasons, but it would look as if those reasons are equally telling for lies, for private lies, the lies that you and I might tell to our friends, our children, our colleagues, etc.
Yes, I agree very much. I think they operate in very much the same way. I also think that to the extent that people lie, in, let's say, in their private life, it's very hard for them to keep that in some kind of separate watertight compartment so that, for instance, to say, well, I'm going to lie in my family, but I'm not going to do it at work. I don't think that people manage to separate those two as well. And then there's another danger, and to the extent that people are themselves careless about lying, they are also going to suspect it more in other people. They're going to suspect it in their co-workers, in their family members, and on the part of their government. So what happens then is that there's more suspicion directed towards government than there necessarily need be. I think that there are quite a few honest public officials, but who are under this cloud of suspicion coming from many directions, including that one. In families, the interesting thing is that, yes, people sometimes are careless about lying. At the same time, I've seen studies that show that when parents are asked, what's the most important trait you would wish for in your child, characteristic or trait, they say honesty. And when students are asked, you know, what's the most important thing you would want to have your roommate be, again, honesty is the one that comes up. So interestingly, this is something we really hope for in other people, even as we're sometimes much more cavalier with respect to it in our own behavior.
All right, one other thing I would like to I sort of glossed over, didn't go back and ask you about. You were talking about shifting or changing perspectives, and I take it that what you want to say is that when we lie to other people, we don't think a whole lot about the effect of our lie on those other people, and therefore we perhaps are more prone to lie than we would be otherwise. Whereas if we would stop and think about what it is like to be lied to, we would be much less likely to fall into the practice of lying. Is that true?
I do think that is true, yes. And again, you know, it has to some extent to do with this idea of slipping into something. Slipping into a lie, let's say to one's child or one's brother or sister or father or mother, is much easier to do if one doesn't stop to think, hey, wait a little, what's going to happen to their relationship to me? And how are they going to think about me from now on once they discover it, if they do? And what is this going to do to how we live together? And again, I think, therefore, that thinking ahead is so important, whether it is through reading books on the subject or taking courses or something like that. It's just to use the imagination again, to put oneself in the place of someone else. And of course, deep down, what we're talking about there is the golden rule.
Okay, we have just about 1 minute left. If you could sort of summarize what lesson you would like the listener to take from your book and from the conversation today.
I guess I would say that the most important thing for me is to be perhaps more charitable with respect to other people, more understanding of everything that can go wrong in their efforts, sometimes to be as honest as they might want to be, and at the same time try to lean over backwards with respect to one's own life. I saw in Immanuel Kant, once again, I brought him up three times now, in one of his books he was saying that we have to keep in mind the fragility of human beings and understand, therefore, that all kinds of things can indeed go wrong for them, but we must never use that fragility as an excuse for ourselves to drift into patterns, say, of lying or other forms of manipulation. So that might be, if I only have a minute, that might be what I would like to say.
Okay, well, thank you very much for appearing on the program today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I've been talking today with Cecil Bach, Distinguished Fellow in the Harvard Center for Population and Development Studies. This has been Hila Follett, for Ideas and Issues. Good day.